Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Okay, take your pick. Today's report on gross domestic product was A, end of the world, or B, not so bad. Hey, at least we gave you multiple choice, right? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, the 30th of January. Good to have you with us. So listen, that's it, right? We're done. The economy shrank last quarter a 10th percent, so let's just pack it in, call it a recession, and go on about our merry way. Yeah, no. Granted, it was the first contraction in more than 3 years, and sure, it surprised a lot of economists, but the end of the world, it ain't. Marketplace's Sally Herships reports.
People of Earth, there is no need to panic. In some cases, a negative GDP could be alarming.
However,
that is not the case this time. Nigel Galt is chief U.S. economist at IHS Global Insight.
Yes, I think this is something where it's best not to focus on the headline, but to be comforted by the details.
In this case, comfort doesn't mean chocolate ice cream. It means rising numbers like consumer spending and private sector investment. Galt says lots of the stats that make up the GDP are doing just fine. So what happened?
There are three reasons for the drop.
Randy Krosner teaches economics at the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business, and he's a former Fed governor.
One is federal government spending, especially defense spending, fell. Inventories, that is those products on the shelves that firms have, went down significantly, and exports fell a bit.
And then there was Hurricane Sandy. So feel more relaxed now? Hold on just a minute. Don't forget about the fiscal cliff. If automatic budget cuts can't be avoided, today's report could be a taste of bad things to come. Barry Bosworth, an economist at the Brookings Institution.
I think there's a lot of people in Washington, congressmen, maybe changed their mind about whether they thought this was all such a good idea.
The real lesson here, say both Bosworth and Nigel Galt, is further cuts in government spending are not a good idea. But don't panic. Congress is bound to figure something out. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
This story now from the Marketplace desk of things you didn't know existed but which are going away. The President's Council on Jobs and Competitiveness is set to disappear tomorrow, 2 years after it was set up to create jobs and competitiveness. From the Marketplace Sustainability desk, Eve Tro has that story.
I asked Brookings Institution economist Gary Burtless what he thought about the President's Jobs Council calling it quits.
Well, as more than one economist would remark to you, I didn't even remember we had one.
Most of the American public would answer the same. Though the 26 members of the council did include some big names, mostly CEOs from companies like GE, Intel, and DuPont. The general idea?
Leaders of the business community could offer some advice to the president on how jobs could be created more quickly with government help.
But those leaders had a hard time seeing past their own interests, says Burtless. Their insights and suggestions mostly applied to their own companies.
They're not thinking hard about the broad policy problems facing the United States of America.
At council meetings, President Obama repeated mantras like this.
I wake up every single morning thinking about how can I make sure that anybody who wants a job is able to get a job.
Then the conversations turned very specific, like an airline saying better air traffic control would let planes idle less and save money on jet fuel. MIT economist Thomas Kohan says the council leaders failed to push hard for government spending on such programs.
We know that infrastructure investments have very good rates of return, both in job creation and in building competitive economy. And yet they didn't really make a strong case.
Nor did the CEOs offer to match government investment with their own money, he says. So the president's job council drummed up some good ideas, but no plan to pay for them. I'm Eve Tro from Marketplace.
Traders backed off some of those multi-year highs in the session on Wall Street. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. During his speech about immigration yesterday in Las Vegas, the president said he agrees with many in Congress that there should be a way for about 11 million illegal immigrants in this country to become citizens. That would make a healthier economy, the president said, in part because those new citizens would be able to make a better living. But if that happens, if paychecks go up, what happens to the businesses that have to pay those wages? From Las Vegas, Adam Burke reports.
If you don't have citizenship papers, work options are limited. Just ask 49-year-old Maria Espinosa.
Without papers, we can do only housekeeping, babysitting, and landscaping, restaurants.
Espinosa has been in the U.S. for 25 years. She's cleaned houses. She's worked in fast food restaurants.
There were times when I was working for $6 the hour, even five.
Espinosa wants better work opportunities, and she actually caught a break at a fast food restaurant a few years ago.
The manager said, "Oh, Maria, your work is pretty good. You can be promoted to be a chief manager or assistant manager." I said, "Wow, sure." But the problem was I had to have a real Social Security number.
That real Social Security number means Espinosa could stand up for herself, ask for more money, maybe even go look for a different job. So if millions of workers are suddenly able to do exactly that, what happens to small businesses who have been relying on cheap labor?
The only ones that are going to go under are the ones that are completely dependent on this undocumented labor force.
Raul Hinojosa is a political economist at UCLA. He studied what happened in 1986. That's the last time that millions of undocumented workers were granted citizenship in the U.S. Wages went up, sweatshops and some other businesses closed down. And he says if Congress acts again, it'll be difficult to find workers for certain kinds of jobs.
You may find it a little bit more difficult to find someone who's going to take care of your grandmother. You may not see a plentiful supply of people parking cars. Restaurants, you may not see as many busboys.
But Hinojosa says some companies adapt. And he says there are economic benefits to small business when workers suddenly become citizens.
They learn English. They finish their GEDs, which they never did before because they were scared and lived in the shadows. They become more productive workers for their employers.
And hopefully as citizens, people like Maria Espinosa can leave behind cleaning and fast food jobs once and for all. In Las Vegas, I'm Adam Burke for Marketplace.
Did you see that item yesterday from the Energy Department that China is burning almost as much coal as the rest of the world combined? That's part of why there's been a toxic cloud over eastern and northern China the past couple of weeks that is now about three times the size of the state of California. The government there has had to go on the defensive about how it's running the world's second biggest economy. We, on the other hand, told our China correspondent Rob Schmitz to go outside.
For the past year, Shanghai resident Xiao Yiping has introduced a new element into her morning routine.
These days, I turn the television on to check the air quality index. Today, the air was really bad. I already knew that because I woke up with an itchy throat, so I put my mask on.
Xiao wears a cloth mask that covers half her face. It's a common defense against air pollution in China, but it's useless. The air today over much of eastern China is high in the tiniest of particulate matter, which can enter your bloodstream. Only a hermetically sealed mask with a special filter can help. Xiao doesn't know where to get that kind of mask. The 61-year-old says the government needs to do a better job at protecting the public.
They say they're tackling pollution, but they're not doing enough. They have to do more. This involves the health and safety of all of us.
The World Bank estimates the economic cost of China's pollution, from healthcare costs to flight cancellations to lost work, is worth nearly $500 billion. 30-year-old Lu Xin works for a construction company. He says the government's done little to address air pollution, not even giving people basic information about how to protect themselves.
My friends and I are constantly checking the air quality index online, but honestly, we're clueless about what preventative measures we can take because the government isn't educating us about it.
Case in point, Zhang Qingju, a woman in her 60s, tells me what she does to protect herself against the smog. When it's this bad, Zhang tells me, I open up my windows to let in some fresh air. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
What's going on with the air quality in China couldn't be called weather in any fair sense of the word. But in the parts of the world where what comes from the sky is just plain old rain or snow or hot or cold, companies often find convenient excuses for bad or good corporate performance. Matt Phillips is a writer at Quartz, and he has put together a list of his favorite weather-related business rationalizations. Matt, it's good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
So, you know, some of this weather stuff makes sense, right? Like if it's too warm, sweaters aren't going to sell and all that stuff. But there are things in here that just kind of boggle the mind, like weather and beer sales in China. Hello?
Yes. That is one of the odd things we saw, that the SAB Miller, the giant South African brewing company, they blamed exceptionally cold and wet winter weather for a decline in their volume of sales in China. Essentially, you can infer some behaviors there. It's cold, you don't really feel like reaching for a frosty one, I guess.
Sometimes I do. I don't know. But there's another wet weather one. Logging companies like to blame the weather when it's too soggy. I don't know.
Yes. Actually, logging, the supply of logs gets disrupted because if it's too wet, it's difficult to get into the forest to cut down the trees. You know, there's all sorts of safety implications, as you can imagine. So wet weather does disrupt the supply of lumber, which can help drive prices of lumber sky high.
All right, here's my favorite, and it's about fat chickens. This is the, I'm just going to read it. The COO of Sanderson Farms says, the weather down here was perfect, and our chickens, the weights, they perform very well in that type of environment. The chickens are too fat.
The chickens were too fat. I'm not actually a chicken biologist. I don't know why this appears to be the case, but it does appear to be the case. And in fact, so fat, the chickens got so fat that they had to ramp up the production at their, essentially, their slaughterhouses and start slaughtering them a little bit early because they were getting too fat for the customers. The chickens were too big to buy.
Which creates its own kind of dilemma, right? You got to hustle and do other stuff.
That's right.
So is this real or is it bogus? Because you hear this stuff all the time.
I think it's real. I think the weather pretty clearly does impact a range of businesses across the country, and all of them in different ways. I mean, companies that sell soup are going to be a lot more pleased with a spurt of cold weather than companies that sell beer or Coca-Cola. Last year was a really wet, cold summer in Europe, and that really hurt Coca-Cola Enterprises' sales in Europe. So the weather's always going to hurt somebody and help somebody, but you'd think that some of our corporate executives could plan for weather to be there.
You'd think, but, you know.
At least.
Are these all just in corporate profit reports? I mean, do you just cull these from what companies actually say on the public record?
Yep. These are all on the record. This is what they say in calls with analysts. They get on there, and they say it's been cold.
or it's been hot, or it's been just right.
Right.
Matt Phillips, he's at Quartz. That's the Atlantic Business Channel's new website. Matt, thanks a lot.
Hey, thanks a million.
Coming up.
When you have an electric, green, clean, quiet car, everybody likes it.
Oh, and it's really fast, too. But first, let's do the numbers. Well, that contraction in GDP that we mentioned helped sour the mood somewhat on Wall Street today. The Dow Industrials fell 44 points, about a third percent, finished at 13,910. The NASDAQ off 11 points, also a third percent, 3142 the number. The S&P 500 slid 5 points, 0.4%, closed at 1501. BlackBerry, the company formerly known as BlackBerry, was among the day's biggest losers. Shares tanked 12% after the company unveiled the latest smartphone model B, BlackBerry 10, that is. It's actually just RIM, too, by the way. Worries about the economy weighed on big oil. Shares of ExxonMobil leaked 1.2%. ConocoPhillips dribbled down 0.9% today. Not all bad news, though. Facebook shares rose about 1.5% today. That's part of the social network's release of better-than-expected profit reports. Despite all the problems with the 787 Dreamliner, shares of Boeing flew 1.25% higher today. That's what a strong earnings report will do for you. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.99%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The Commerce Department reports on personal income and spending for December. Are you working and are you saving? A Senate committee is talking about you. Well, all of us, really. The panel asks, are workers saving enough for retirement? And speaking of retirement, the first Social Security check was issued on January 31st, 1940. Ida Mae Fuller received $22.54. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. All right, I'm going to try to sum up JCPenney's business strategy over the past year or so right now. You ready? Here we go. Everything's on sale. Nothing's on sale. All right, everything's on sale again. You think I'm kidding, but I'm not. The company is turning around its turnaround strategy, a move perhaps related to its looming fourth consecutive quarter of red ink. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
I found Bonnie Fisher browsing the clearance racks at a JCPenney near Baltimore. She remembers when Penney's rolled back the sales.
I used to get lots of coupons all the time, and I loved and I was all excited to come to the store with my coupons. And since I haven't been getting them, I haven't been here in a long time.
Penney's says it isn't bringing back coupons, but it will revive some of the sales it killed off last year. The company tried to break the cycle of marking prices up, only to keep knocking them down. Instead, it promised low prices every day. Shoppers stayed home. Paco Underhill studies consumer behavior at the research firm Enviracell. He says Penney's was right to try.
Sales are a little like heroin, meaning that the more you use it, the less effective it becomes.
But once you train your customers to expect sales, it's hard to retrain them. And Candace Corlett with WSL Strategic Retail says the JCPenney customer was well-trained.
Part of the pleasure she gets out of JCPenney is the reward of great deals.
It's not because the shirts were $2. They could have been $10, but if they had a big sale sign and they used to be $50, you just feel like you're getting a deal.
Penney's will try another tactic to give shoppers like Bonnie Fisher the impression of savings. Starting today, it'll post the manufacturer's suggested price next to Penney's price on more tags so shoppers can get that bargain feeling. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
More than 100 million people are going to tune into the Super Bowl this weekend. Some of them for the ads, probably. Most of them for the game, which promises to be 3+ hours of really big and really fast men running into each other at full speed. Those collisions and hard hits have started getting another kind of attention, though, neurological. The NFL Players Association has given Harvard Medical School a $100 million grant to study player health. From the health desk at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports.
Football is violent. That's the sound of an NFL linebacker pushing, shoving, throwing his body as he tries to tackle running backs and wide receivers. What are the long-term consequences of colliding with 200-pound men again, again, and again?
Not everybody who gets hit in the head gets a concussion. Not everybody who gets a concussion someday is not well.
That's Harvard's Lee Nadler, who will be heading up this decade-long study into head trauma and all other injuries that come from playing tackle football. Nadler says the goal is to figure out who's at risk for a neurological disorder and, if possible, how to prevent certain injuries. The NFL players themselves are funding this $100 million study out of their own pockets. Duke sports law professor Paul Hagen says they had to.
They need to have, I think, a relatively clear sense of what the dangers are because this is their livelihood.
Hagen says medical research will give players more leverage negotiating game changes, like tackling rules and extending the season. But that same research could also put the NFL, a $9 billion a year industry, in jeopardy.
Essentially, what I think we're talking about is a serious threat to a sport at absolutely the height of its popularity.
Sunday may be about the halftime show, the quirky commercials, and the final score. But long term, the game is all about the hits, the hits, the hits. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Innovation can take many forms, many roads, if you will, on its way from idea to final product. But it takes few of those roads as quickly as a California man and what may be the fastest street-legal green car in the world. Our story comes from Alex Chadwick.
The last time I talked to Mike Pethel on the radio, this is what he told me.
The car is going to be on the road soon, and it's going to be fast. It's going to be really fast.
Yeah, well, I'd heard that. I met Mike a year and a half ago in a neighborhood garage, and ever since, I've been watching this slow transformation of an old BMW into maybe the fastest green street car in the world. Okay, so a couple of months ago, the car not quite done, the hood still missing, we take it out one night. Now, if the sheriff is listening, I'm not saying that this did happen, but if it did, it went like this. Evening. On a long, straight, nearby street. This street. Nobody walks here. No dogs. Not much traffic. There's a row of cars parallel parked in front of two-story condos on the right. And up ahead, maybe 300 feet, a dark Mercedes is backing into an open space. The car paused, like it can't decide about starting over. Nothing else on the road. We ease forward 20 feet, and he hits the throttle. I feel the car bulge like a pumped muscle, and we are going unbelievably fast, unbelievably quickly. The Mercedes is still frozen half in our lane up ahead, but not ahead anymore. We are on it, doing about 80. Mike twitches the steering wheel. The BMW jumps a half step left past the Mercedes, and the back end breaks free. We're sliding. He touches the throttle again, almost like he's thinking it. The car leaps forward and grabs a straight line into the roadway ahead. It's supercar, if it happened.
That feels pretty good, eh?
3 months later, I'm at Elko Welding in Venice, California, where Mike lives. A lot of the work on the car gets done in this shrine to the machine age. The BMW is up on a lift.
So what I was worried about was this piece right here.
Mike wants to change the mechanical assembly that connects the drive shaft to the rear wheels. The car is powerful enough to tear itself apart. This is where the stress will show.
The last couple of times I took off really aggressively, it seemed to act differently. And I thought if I'm going to give some rides, I wouldn't want it to go shooting sideways, you know, for any reason.
He's an obsessive, remaking the BMW for extreme performance. But in the months I've watched the project, I've come to think his real goal is innovation itself, rethinking cars. He's developed new motors. They can run a race car or a bread truck, he says. It's all in the tweaks. This from a no-college techno-savant turned radical green.
When I was 12 years old, I was making electric cars out of little wooden toys that I would buy in the grocery store. I can visualize electron flow and impedances, and I can know how coils and capacitors work. You know, basic electronic components are kind of easy to understand. Yeah,
easy for him. His technical skills afford him his means. He co-founded a big digital production house in L.A., Company 3, where he works on films and ad campaigns. He loves speed, but not the commercials he was making for cars that were noisy and dirty.
I just wanted something really clean that I wouldn't have a problem driving around.
He began with an early 70s BMW Classic, a 3.0 CS, a car he and his dad swapped back and forth for years. That's how it still looks, the polished light pewter body like a Greyhound at rest. But under the hood, the engine compartment looks bare. The pair of electric motors are a fraction the size of a big gas engine. Tesla and other electrics run on alternating current, AC. Mike's are direct current, DC motors built to his design. No others like them are known.
The DC motor is a real kind of a primitive device, but it works. It can't not work. Magnetic fields work. Electrons work. You put force in there and it turns the motor. So it's easier to make a DC motor work.
And it works really great. If you connect it to 2,400 lithium iron phosphate battery cells in three custom boxes made from bulletproof glass, 1 megawatt of energy, 1 million watts, that's enough to run 750 homes in
car. It's an insane amount of power. Okay, the car's ready again. Let's see how it does. You probably do not want this car. It uses power so quickly it needs a recharge every 50 miles or so. But that's the design. Supercar as extreme daily driver. It's how Mike goes to work. 5 miles in a stock-looking, elegant automobile with 800 horsepower. You don't want this car. But you might like another version. You can make a DC motor do whatever you want, or Mike can, and maybe that's where this innovation leads. Electrics are coming, Mike Pethel says, like his car or not.
I mean, if I just had a really loud car, it might be exciting to some motorheads. But when you have an electric, green, clean, quiet car, everybody likes it.
Quiet. Huh. The tires are smoking.
Look at the cloud back there.
Oh, man.
I'm not going to go back that way. I'm going to go around the block.
Good.
From an undisclosed street in the city of Los Angeles, this is Alex Chadwick for Marketplace.
That's just the burnout of the tire. Nothing's wrong with the car.
I've said it before. I'll say it again. Reporters get to have all the fun, man. Alex is the host of Burn, an energy journal. It's from Sound Vision Productions, produced by this company, APM, and support from the National Science Foundation and the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. We've got videos and pictures of Alex and Mike in the car, if it happened, on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which commerce ruins one of the last bastions of innocence and purity left in this world, the smell of a baby. The Italian fashion house Dolce & Gabbana is coming out with a perfume for babies. Notes of citrus, honey, and melon, we're told. So, yeah, that. It has given us a great idea for a series, though. Here you go. Completely unnecessary things for people to spend their money on. Send us your recommendations. You can tweet us at Marketplace APM. And that is Marketplace. We're done. The Dow off 44 points today, about a third of 1%, finished at 13,910. The NASDAQ off 11 points, 3142. At the bell, the S&P 500 down 5 points, 1501. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow. And this is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.